I'm Brian Scordato, and this is the Idea to Startup podcast brought to you by Tacklebox. We accelerate ideas into real companies through the Tacklebox membership, and we think through startup strategy every Wednesday on the Idea to Startup podcast. You're here because you're thinking about an idea, or you're ready to launch something, or you already launched something and you're running full steam ahead. We're here to help with the counterintuitive stuff. On to it. Today, we are doing a long overdue mailbag. Three great questions. Each one has come up a bunch of times before, and honestly, each one is good enough to deserve its own episode. Maybe someday. Today's lighter episode will act like a bit of a palate cleanser, a lemon sorbet in podcast form, to the dense ERP rubric episodes we just put out, which you should definitely listen to if you haven't. Responses for those ranged from, quote, I listened three times in a row and furiously took about 20 pages of notes, to Kevin in Minnesota, who said, quote, honestly, that was a bit too much. Thanks for reaching out. In fairness, he did try to soften the blow by saying Idea to Startup was his favorite podcast, and then ended with what I think was just a joke he thought I'd like, because out of nowhere he wrote, by the way, if yogurt is so cultured, how come I never see it at the museum? Then signed his name with no other explanation. Every fiber of my being wanted to reply, that joke was honestly a bit too much, but it wasn't, and I couldn't pretend it was. I loved it. You're okay in my book, Kev. Anyway, we are way off track already. Let's get into the emails. And if you've got a question, send it in to team@gettacklebox.com, as always. We'll answer one question, we'll do a little jazz, then answer the other two, and get you out of here on time. Question one, how to commit to an idea, aka idea FOMO. Our first email comes from Shale in Wisconsin. Shale writes, hi, I'm having trouble with something you talk about all the time, committing to an idea and sprinting on it for a set period of time. I've got a few ideas, but I don't really like one any more than the others. Honestly, I think they all could work. So when I try to focus on one, I have this heavy feeling in my gut that I'm missing out on the others, like idea FOMO. So I always wind up kind of doing a little bit of work on each idea each week, and I don't end up getting anywhere. I guess the headline is I feel like I'm doing lots of random things on a few different ideas and not getting anywhere. I don't really know how to have a firm direction or North Star. How do I commit and stick to an idea? Ooh-wee, this is a loaded one. And it's a question we get a ton. How do you make early progress when you aren't confident you're moving the right direction? There are two ways to answer this question. The first way is to assume that committing to an idea, in Shale's words, is a discipline problem, helping her work harder. The second is to assume that commitment is a strategy problem, helping her have a strategy. Most founders assume they're struggling with the first, discipline, when it is almost always the second, strategy. Since I don't have any more color on why Shale, very cool name by the way, can't commit, and I'm not super interested in finding out because I think both discipline and strategy are interesting and relevant and usually wound together tighter than a Twizzler, we're just going to hit them both. Discipline and strategy. The two levers of a successful anything. Each has a story and a framework. So we'll start with discipline, because it's quicker and relatively straightforward, although, as usual, a few parts are counterintuitive and trip people up. Let's jump in. Discipline. For Shale to be successful, she'll need to put her head down and sprint on one idea for long enough to feel the weight of it, to feel the idea sand between her toes, to understand the nuances between customers and their specific problems, to form opinions on the way customers solve those problems now, to create relationships with people up and down the trust stack to see how hard customer acquisition is going to be, to find out where her customers hang out now, both digitally and physically, to know what wild success looks like for them and how they're going to measure it, to see who motivates them. Remember, people are motivated by envy, not greed. And to find a way to reliably find 20 potential customers in a pinch. In short, Shale needs depth. If you don't show up to your idea with depth, often referred to as domain expertise, you've got to earn it through interactions with your customers. This will help you find a secret, the thing you know that everyone else doesn't that anchors your business. Every business that works is based on a secret, and finding it takes time and digging and effort. It takes discipline. You never know when a secret is going to show up. We've had founders run 10 totally surface-level customer interviews before the 11th one blew their mind. We recently had a founder run 50 customer interviews with coffee shop managers that went absolutely nowhere before they shadowed a manager for a day and uncovered an insight that's allowed them to build a very useful service over the last 6 months. Discipline helps you wade through the early days because you won't have signs telling you that you're close to that aha moment. Discipline requires two things, levers and hooks. And with that, let's tell a story. I'm training to run the New York City Marathon again, and the plan is for this to be the last time. There's an aggressive time in my head I want to beat, and when I beat it, hopefully, I'll move on to a hobby that doesn't require me to fling a toddler and a baby on my wife for three-hour training runs every weekend. The past few weeks, I've been trying to pick the right marathon training program, which feels a bit like trying to pick the right cereal at the grocery store. There are hundreds of options with totally superficial differences. And then, a few days ago, one program leapt off the page. Nearly every program I'd seen to this point talked about helping you hit a goal time, and their specific mix of long runs and short runs and recovery runs and fartleks, an actual thing, would be better than someone else's mix of those because of whatever. But this new program had a totally different focus. Here is their H1. A marathon training program built to make sure you don't get injured and miss your race. Some context. I've trained for the New York City Marathon 3 times, and I've run it once. Injuries stopped me twice. I was intrigued. The site continued. There are 2 reasons people who train for marathons don't run them. First, they get injured during training and physically can't run on race day. And second, they get injured during training, and while they continue to train after, they aren't prepared on race day. Our program is built to make sure you don't get hurt, which means you'll do every training run, which means you'll be prepared on race day, which means you'll run the race and probably hit your time. Marathon training is about preventing injuries. This reminded me of one of my favorite quotes by Shane Parrish. The shortest path is the one you don't abandon. If you're hurt, you can't train, which means you won't reach your goals. Simple. The program then dug in on each of its 2 foundational elements, avoiding injury and sticking to the program. They cited numerous studies that showed running injuries happened in 2 scenarios, on long runs that were over an hour and a half, and during aggressive increases in weekly miles. Nearly every other program had at least 1 run each week that was well over an hour and a half, and they increased miles aggressively. This program doesn't. Instead, they focus on what they call the foundation of endurance, which is VO2 max. This is the measure of your body's ability to use oxygen during exercise. If you increase that, you'll apparently be able to run for longer. And the best way to increase it is through varied types of exercise and pace. So their training program has a bunch of short runs and interval trainings and sprints. And it also includes swimming and strength sessions. You run way fewer miles than other programs. There are only 3 runs over 2 hours in the whole program, yet pages of reviews saying that on race day, running for 4 hours wasn't a problem. This training approach, removing injury and focusing on VO2 max, is their lever. The other huge part of the program is the hook, the way they keep you on track. When you join, you're added to a Slack group with all trainees for your race split into 2 teams of 5. Each Sunday, everyone posts their weekly schedule. At midnight, on a random day each week, 1 runner from each team gets tagged and must post their workout or admit they missed it. Teams earn a point for a completed workout and lose a point for a skipped one. A live scoreboard tracks all teams, with members of the winning team getting a hoodie. Is this a bit silly? Of course it is. But do you feel awful if your name comes up and you didn't do your workout and you lose your team a point? Of course. Lever and hook. Lever, do the stuff that moves you forward in the smartest way possible. Hook, create external accountability to hold you to it. The shortest path is the one you don't abandon. So for Shale, and potentially for you, the goal is to create levers and hooks. Begin by working backwards, like the running program. Start with the reasons you, or most founders, won't end up getting anywhere with their startup idea. The startup version of a running injury. Here are a few ideas for Shale. First, they never talk to enough customers, so they aren't confident enough in the problem to not second guess it constantly. And they aren't externally motivated because they just live in their own heads. Second, they don't set clear validation milestones, so they're always working in circles with no visual progress as a motivator. Third, they try to validate everything, customers, product, pricing, etc., all at once, instead of picking one core assumption at a time and tackling it, so they get some momentum. Fourth, they jump between ideas, so they never get anywhere. Fifth, they give up on a strategy when they're 85% of the way towards something interesting, because the closer you get to something real, the scarier that real thing gets. Pick your version of the runner's injury and write it down. Now, architect a program for yourself that's oriented around making sure that thing doesn't happen. So if your, quote, injury is not speaking to customers, what's a program of levers and a hook to make you speak with customers? Maybe you need to send 10 cold emails each morning before you have coffee, which means you'll start to build out the system to make those 10 emails better and more targeted and increase response rates. And your hook is that maybe you host an event or sign up to a conference or buy a summer slot at a farmer's market or join a startup program or something you can't get out of. Now, to the more interesting side of the problem and the more likely reason you aren't able to move forward, strategy. Strategy and discipline are inextricably tied because procrastination, or not committing to an idea, is very rarely a pure discipline problem like most founders assume it is. It's often an emotional problem. Startups are likely very different from anything you've ever done in your life. Even if you're the first employee at a startup, your path has been laid out. There are goals in existing projects and probably KPIs and OKRs. You're told, even if it's broadly, what to do. When it's your own thing, as my dad used to say, you can always scrap it and build a toaster, meaning literally everything is on the table at any moment. That is terrifying. If discipline is the ability to run fast, strategy is telling you where to run. Running fast is hard if you aren't confident you're going the right way. That's why so many founders tell me they wake up early, get to their desk, and can't do anything. Discipline without strategy is worthless, intertwined like a Twizzler. The way to increase discipline is to clarify your strategy, which brings up what maybe feels like an obvious question, but might not be. What is strategy, especially for a company at the early stage? I think about strategy as using your unfair advantage to make it outrageously hard for anyone else to compete with you. If you're making a coffee machine with no plastic, and all the other coffee machines have plastic in them, if you lean fully into the no plastic thing, it'll be really hard for competitors to react. Because if they pivot and make a no plastic machine, they're undermining all their current plastic machines, which make up all their sales. Strategy is when your move benefits you and hurts competition. But again, at this stage, that isn't all that helpful because you might not know what your unfair advantage is just yet. As with most things that are hard to pin down, I find it's best to start with what strategy isn't. Richard Rumelt, in his wonderful book, Good Strategy, Bad Strategy, defines bad strategy in four ways. First, fluff. In his words, fluff is a form of gibberish masquerading as strategic concepts or arguments. It uses Sunday words, words inflated and unnecessarily abstruse and apparently esoteric concepts to create the illusion of high-level thinking. I will say that for a guy talking about Sunday words, he sure used a bunch of Sunday words, but you get it. We'll move on. Next is the most important one, failure to face the challenge. Rumelt says that bad strategy fails to recognize or define a challenge. When you cannot define the challenge, you cannot evaluate a strategy to improve it. I've got a post-it with this written on my monitor. Next is mistaking goals for strategy. Many bad strategies are just statements of desire rather than plans for overcoming obstacles. And finally, bad strategic objectives. A strategic objective is set by a leader as a means to an end. Strategic objectives are bad when they fail to address critical issues or when they're impractical. I think that bad strategy boils down to avoidance. Doing everything you can, except explicitly stating the challenge and choosing a path to attack it that plays to your strengths. which means good strategy is about choosing a path. Rumelt helps you choose that path with a framework he calls the strategy kernel, made up of three parts: diagnosis, guiding policy, and coherent actions. Here's Rumelt on the three parts. First is diagnosis. A good diagnosis simplifies the often overwhelming complexity of reality by identifying certain aspects of the situation as critical. Next is guiding policy, an overall approach chosen to cope with or overcome the obstacles identified in the diagnosis. And finally, coherent actions. These are steps that are coordinated with one another to work together in accomplishing the guiding policy. This is a somewhat verbose way of saying you have to identify the real obstacle, pick an overall approach to attack that obstacle that plays to your strengths, and break that approach down to bite-sized bits. Rumelt's strategy approach is effective for your actual business as well as your approach for validating and developing a hypothesis around a business idea. Here is what it might look like. First, diagnosis. You need to clearly define that real challenge here. And the challenge almost always is something like, I don't have enough conviction about my idea and what I'm supposed to do next. Some questions that might help are things like, what's the actual obstacle preventing progress? Or what characteristics would an idea I was confident was worth pursuing have? If you've got challenges with a specific idea, that works too. Maybe you're worried about selling to B2B or entering a market where you've got no experience. Great, write it down. Next is guiding policy, how you'll overcome the challenge. If the big thing preventing your progress is speaking with customers, maybe you'll choose an idea where you naturally have the most access to customers to speak to. If the problem is you aren't sure customers feel real pain, maybe you choose a problem you're personally dealing with. If it's insecurity about your ability to build an impactful business, maybe you pick an idea where your background gives you a serious advantage, an idea you've been subconsciously preparing to start for years. And finally, coherent actions, your sprint plan. Translate your guiding policy into 2-week sprints. Maybe weeks 1 and 2 are 15 customer interviews. Weeks 3 and 4 are intent tests. Weeks 5 and 6 are concierge MVP with one customer. And then the last day of week 6 is blocked off for your decision. Is this idea worth another 6 weeks? What hypotheses and assumptions are you still working on? What customers are most excited? And on and on. There needs to be an end date where you step back and reflect. There also needs to be a kill switch, a clear scenario where you're going to ditch the idea. Maybe it's if 90% of people you interview don't see this as a real problem they want to solve, or if you can't get in touch with 10 people in a week. It doesn't necessarily mean to kill the idea altogether, but to adjust assumptions or your hypothesis or your customer and start back at week 1. If I tell you to hop on a treadmill and sprint, you'll tell me no. If I tell you to hop on a treadmill and sprint for 3 minutes, you might do it. Strategy for founders is about making the best with the incomplete information you've got, moving forward in a world of uncertainty. This usually requires extra structure, something founders don't anticipate and often buck against, and definitely have never set up for themselves before. What feels like a discipline problem is almost certainly a strategy problem. So, define the problem, build a set of actions to go after it, create an end date, create kill criteria, then use the levers and hooks of discipline to get it done. So, Shale, run through this system, strategy, then discipline, and get to it. Whew, that was a little longer than I thought it was going to be, but hopefully it was useful. Time to break. We'll get to a few more questions after. A little smooth jazz. Hey, we finally got a free trial at Tacklebox. So if you've got a startup idea and a full-time job, head to gettacklebox.com and get started. We'll create some structure for you and get you going on interviews before you have to pay a dime. Think of it as instant momentum. Back to it. Question 2, the key stories. The first question was long and startup strategy focused. The second one will be shorter and also still startup strategy focused. The pod is called Idea to Startup. What'd you expect? Here is James in Florida. Hey, I've listened to like 200 episodes of the podcast and you tell tons of stories and give tons of frameworks. What piece of advice do you give founders the most? What are the stories to remember? Thanks, James. Great question. You know I love telling my stories. There are two key ones. One is my story and one actually isn't. We'll start with the one that isn't. I've heard it's from a guy named Astro Teller, but my old boss used to use it all the time too. It's got a fair amount of strategy in it, and it is, without a doubt, the thing our best founders do and our worst founders do not. Let's say I told you that in 2 months, you needed to get a monkey to recite Hamlet on top of a pedestal. How much time would you spend building the pedestal? It seems like a silly question because obviously you wouldn't spend any time at all on the pedestal. On the day you needed the monkey to recite Hamlet, you'd probably find a pedestal or use a chair or something. The pedestal doesn't matter. Anyone can get a pedestal. But like 95% of founders I meet are spending most of their time chiseling away at a pedestal. Because making a pedestal makes sense. We can wrap our arms around it. We can tell ourselves that, hey, the monkey's going to need that pedestal eventually, so we might as well get started on it now. And then we get into it and we decide to make it a nicer pedestal or a taller pedestal or paint it Carolina blue. The pedestal dilemma is the dilemma of sequencing. I'll have to do this eventually, so I might as well do it now, is logic that will work exceptionally well in like 99% of your life and absolutely torpedo your chances of building a successful business. When you're building a company, your runway is going to be finite, either the time you can spend or the money you can spend or both. If a business is made up of 1,000 components, 995 of them won't have the potential to create any separation or contrast between you and a competitor. 5 will. So obviously, you should spend absolutely all of your time on those 5, especially early on, because what you're testing in the early days is your hypothesis that one of those 5 is actually a driver of contrast. So spend all your time on it and see. When I meet with founders at Tacklebox, it's pretty common for me to say, you're working on the pedestal. People immediately know what I'm talking about. If you're building an AI tool that'll help restaurants source sustainable seafood, and you spend literally any time on the UX of the tool early, you're working on the pedestal. The only thing that matters is finding restaurants that currently struggle to source sustainable seafood. And not just struggle. Their whole business is being held back because they cannot source sustainable seafood. This is their top priority. If a restaurant doesn't see it as a top priority, they won't be your first customer. So find someone else who would immediately see enormous value from sourcing sustainable seafood and understand their process. Then, and only then, find suppliers who can help solve that customer's problem. And never, ever write a thought piece about sustainable fishing practices and post it to LinkedIn. Anyone can do that. Not anyone can dig in with customers. So, for your business, what's the monkey and what's the pedestal? What's the hard thing other people won't be able to do? Are you spending 99% of your time on it, or are you making pedestals? The second is my story, and the framework is called Sell the Position. And this one comes up every single week. I'll link to the longer story in the show notes, but the short version is that the wealthiest guy in my town growing up got that way by, in his words, selling the position. He worked at a hedge fund and had a few traders underneath him. He was small potatoes to start. Whenever any of his traders had positions that had gone sour, they'd show up in his office and try to convince him that it wasn't time to sell that position yet. The company would turn it around. For years, every time this happened, he'd make the decision. Did he believe that, say, Apple stock was going to make a big turnaround or not? Then, one day, he changed his approach. Now, every time a trader showed up and said that, say, the $5 million of Apple stock they owned, which was currently down 10%, was about to turn around, he told them to sell the position. Sell every dollar of it. The next morning, he'd give them back those $5 million and say if they wanted to, they could buy back their Apple stock. Or they could buy anything else. 99% of the time, they bought something else. The spell had been broken. He rode this approach all the way to the top, eventually becoming CEO. I'm pretty sure that most of the things you do each day, we do each day, I'm no exception, we do because we did them yesterday. If we were picking from all the infinite options available to us, we'd choose to do something else. But we suffer from loss aversion. We value what we have 2x more than what we don't. Until the spell is broken and we don't have that thing, we can't make decisions clearly. Sell the position works best for early stage founders outside of their business, looking at their non-startup life and figuring out where they can free up space. Would they actively choose what they spend their time on now from a buffet with lots of other options? monkeys and pedestals and selling the position get used every week. Oh, and I just thought of one more bonus one. This is much more of a prompt, but I think it's as helpful as a prompt can possibly be. And here it is. What would a customer pay you $10,000 for? This works for businesses that sell $25 winter hats or $5 lattes or $500 software services or $2,500 consulting packages, though that's probably the upper limit. If you charge more than $2,500 for your product, change that number to $50K or $100K. The number should feel strikingly high. So you're selling $5 lattes. What would a customer pay you $10,000 for? This is a great way to think about who really values what you make. Good question, James. On to the last one, because this episode is getting a bit long. This is a short one, and it's from a founder we'll leave nameless. Hey, I'm 50. I know that isn't old, but I'm thinking of starting a company, and companies take time. If I start a company today and it takes 7 to 10 years, that means I'll be 60. So, should I still do it? I've gotten this type of email a ton, and the specific age has nothing to do with it. I've had people say, I'm 25, which means I'll be 35 and will have missed prime earning years. Or I'm 40 and my kids are 3 and 5. That means I'll be 50 and miss their formative years, and on and on. People are terrified of a 10-year commitment, which I get. So when people hit me with math, I answer them with math, and it's complicated. So bear with me. If you're 50 and you start a company that takes 10 years to be successful, by the time it is, you'll be 60. But if you're 50 and you don't start a company that takes 10 years to be successful, after those 10 years of not working on a company, how old are you going to be? My math tells me you'll still be 60. You just won't have a company. And I totally understand that this question is about opportunity cost and energy levels and a bunch of other feelings under the surface. But I think it comes down to a regret calculation. If you'll regret not starting a company, you should go for it. Moving purposely towards something creates all sorts of other positive benefits, even if they aren't directly related to your startup. And whatever you think is going to happen during those 10 years isn't a guarantee either. Just because you don't start a startup doesn't mean you'll have time and money or whatever else. It only guarantees that you won't have a startup. Piece of cake. Trying things is always better than not trying things. And if you're going to regret something, you should probably do it. Okay, got a bit long, but hopefully it was helpful. And there are a bunch of other questions here I wanted to hit that I didn't get to. Maybe I'll do another one of these in a few weeks. And obviously, if you want to ask me these questions in person or build your startup with us, head to gettacklebox.com and check out our programs. Have a great week. This was the Idea to Start a Podcast brought to you by Tacklebox, and we kind of just did the ad, so just enjoy some jazz.